add WFAN to your contacts to talk New York sports with us at 888-808-1019. Powered by Paramount Plus. Stream the NFL on CBS live on Paramount Plus.
Oh, I know all the words. I'm not going to do it here. 888-808-1019. I used to do it at parties, though. Especially, there's like a just straight up verse with no hook song called Rabbit Run on the soundtrack of the 8 Mile movie. That one I actually would do it. Think of how corny and dumb that is. But I did it. Well, people would say I couldn't do it. I would do the "You Can't Handle the Truth" speech as well. That people think I don't have memorized. I have the "You Can't Handle the Truth" speech memorized. Do it right now for you, but I won't. But I can, because I did it once in an acting class. I was just acting. I could do a lot of the Willie Loman speeches too that I did, but I don't remember the whole thing. For some reason, I did the "You Can't Handle the Truth," but that was just for a high school thing. That wasn't a real legit thing. Then I did, but in college, I did a Willie Loman scene, and I did Benedict from a Midsummer's Night Dream. Right? No, not, I'm sorry. Much Ado About Nothing. Sorry. Much Ado About Nothing. That I vaguely still have memorized. But let's get back to the calls instead of my acting career. And I actually went, you know what, that's funny. I went to acting school at Nassau Community College. I took an acting class. And I'll never forget, the first day I'm sitting in there, where, you know, we walk, we start doing whatever exercises, vocal exercises, whatever it was. And I'm staring at this kid across the way. And I'm just like, I know this dude from somewhere. I know this guy from somewhere. And I can't figure it out. And I'm thinking, I'm like, I just know this guy from somewhere. And then, of course, it only took about 20 minutes before he announced to the class that he was the best friend in Jack with Robin Williams. You know the movie Jack, where he's like the kid who ages four times faster than everybody else, and he's 40, he looks 40 at 10. And like, it's, his name is Vincent something. He's like kind of very Italian looking with the dark hair. His best friend in Jack was in my intro to acting class at Nassau Community College. And I was like, what the? All right. Why are you here?
I thought you were going to say like Macaulay Culkin or something.
No, yeah, exactly. It was Shirley Temple. I was like, I knew this. No. It was the kid who played, and it's 100% it was him. As soon as he said it, I said, that's who he is. He was the kid who played Jack's best friend, Robin Williams' best friend in the movie Jack. And then he said he did a bunch of Law and Orders, but, you know. So I guess he was going back to school and just figured he'd get easy credits with acting because he was, like, you know, already a thespian. And I was like, what are you doing here? And why'd you have to tell us within 5 minutes? Couldn't you just sit in the back of the class and not be the guy from... The guy, you know, not be the guy from... The movie with Robin Williams?
Seth Smith, the baseball player, was in that movie?
I mean, I suppose that's possible.
According to Google.
Yeah, I know. I don't know. I got to look it up. But yes, that was him, 100%. And he was in my intro to acting class at Nassau Community College. I'm like, what are you doing here? Why are you taking everybody else's opportunity to be in the play or whatever? Although I did musicals in high school, but then I got into athletics. They needed me. The team needs them. So I had to, but yeah, Jack. I'm trying to find what year was Jack? 1996, there he is. Jennifer Lopez was the teacher. I remember that. Let me see the guy's name. Is that it, Adam? Yep. Adam Zolotin. I don't know. Adam Zolotin. But he must be from New York. Born November 29th, 1983. Yeah, that's me. He's 40 years old. He was in my intro to acting class. Hey, is there a scene with him working with Bradley Cooper? What the? No, I don't think that's Bradley Cooper. The guy had some career. Then he's sitting in my intro to acting class.
Well,
2002. Yeah, I know. I guess it was 2002, right? I graduated high school in 01, so maybe 2002, 2003. Yeah, you know. I've been in a bunch of Law and Orders. I was Robin Williams' best friend in the movie Jack. Like, it's weird. What are you doing here? It's like, you know, taking a singing class, and it's like, hi, yeah, I'm Jennifer Hudson. I won American. I finished second in American Idol 2 years ago, and you know, I'm working on a movie now with Eddie Murphy. Like, yeah, okay, great, thanks. Why are you here? You know, we're all just a bunch of idiots, right? Trying to get an easy credit, but that's true. 888-808-1019. I was a better Willie Loman than him anyway. Everybody in class said it to me. You're better than the Jack guy. Yeah, thanks. I am. Val in the Bronx. What's up, Val?
Brother Mac, what's going on, Dan? How you doing, bro?
Good, man. How are you?
I'm all right. Yo, you know what? I'm feeling kind of up right now because four of the five names I gave you are actually showing themselves right now. And the one that's not showing himself is because he's staying less and he's doing the quiet work. Yo, and I'm going to tell you right now, the stuff that happened with Strowman, right?
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to actually take a different take on this.
Okay.
And I usually don't say this, but I feel like exceptional things happen and we had exceptional issues. And the way that it worked out, while it was not the best, actually turned out to give the best result. We've had Glaber, who's been kind of like, quote unquote, as everybody likes to say, kind of lacking focus from time to time, lackadaisical and things of that nature and so on and so on.
Yeah.
And everybody has rumored, everybody who's in the Yankee Hate Coalition keeps telling us that we should be afraid of this moment that's going to happen with Strowman because he's a me-first guy. At some point, it's going to show itself, da-da-da-da-da-da, yada-yada-yada, boom-boom. In that moment right there, okay, I think the way that it happened, and I'm not one for somebody showing up a teammate, but I think just the circumstances and the way that it happened, because Glaber needed like that kind of tough love in that moment right there, because his mind is like, you know, on the emotional things, I think he's caught up right now in the fact that, you know, he's in this free agency year and, you know, all this stuff is going on. He always seems to kind of like slow down just around the trade deadline. Historically, if you look back at the numbers, this always happens because he hears his name and he starts to get kind of rattled and da-da-da-da.
Right.
Strowman yelling at him like that in a weird kind of way kind of gave him some tough love to just be like, yo, just get into it, bro. Stop. You know, when all the coddling that was going on before and nobody really talking to him, somebody finally raised their voice at him. Strowman had his, quote-unquote, from the Yankee coalition of haters saying, oh, this the me moment. He had his chance to actually get out of his pocket and show himself to be kind of like doing something that's not necessarily according to the Yankee way. And one of the five names that I told you last week, Aaron Judge, showed up as a captain. And while I don't even, a lot of people are misconstruing what he said, because from what I heard, what he actually told Strowman was, I apologize. And he actually spoke about something that a mistake that he felt he made in the field.
Well, he tried to take the blame. He tried to take the blame off Glaber and say, don't be mad at him, be mad at me. I should have caught that ball. Yeah.
And that diffused the whole thing. And it kind of showed Strowman to kind of like this me moment right now. I need to be away from that. My captain is talking to me. I need to be about the team. But it also gave Glaber, as much as it gave him this sympathetic kind of view for in everybody's mind, it also gave him that tough love moment like, yo, wake up, bro. You know what I'm saying? So while I'm not, like I said, it's not the best circumstances, but in a strange kind of funny way, I feel like we got the best result out of it.
Well, I mean, yeah, I don't think that's a different take, honestly. I think that's pretty much what it's what I said. I think it's what a lot of people felt.
I've heard a lot of people say, you know, like, you shouldn't be doing that.
Well, of course. And listen, he shouldn't be doing it. I mean, both can be true. Both can be true. And both can be true. I don't think he should have done it. And I don't know if it necessarily sparked Glaber in here. Let me give you a different take on that, because I heard Sean say this. I've heard other people say this. We don't want to give Boone credit for nothing. I mean, actually, we just don't want to give Boone credit for anything. I mean, it's just, it's not the benching. It's not the benching, no. It's not the benching. It's not the 2 days off. It's Stroman yelling at him on the field. Right? The benching had nothing to do with it. It's not what Boone did. No, no. Let's not give Boone any credit. God forbid we give Boone credit. Let's give Stroman all the credit for yelling at him. Clearly. That's what he needed. It was, you know, getting taken out of the lineup and benched and put his ass on the bench, that didn't impact him at all. Getting a couple days to clear his head, that didn't impact him at all. It was Stroman yelling at him. Okay. I'm not saying it necessarily wasn't. I think the entire team needed that more than Gleyber Torres. And yes, it was directed at Gleyber Torres. And yes, Judge did. There's two ways to go about it in that moment as a captain. One, get on Stroman and say, we don't do that here. Which was the way it was handled with David Wells all those years ago when he used to get on players. Or there's, hey, don't be mad at him. I blew the play in the outfield. And take the blame. Make Stroman feel kind of warranted in his frustration, but misguided in how he did it, as opposed to just saying, hey, you don't do that here. And I think, Judge, that was a masterful play. It de-escalated the situation while giving Stroman enough of a feeling like, hey, I wasn't in the wrong. And I don't know if he was completely in the wrong. Listen, he went absolutely ballistic and was still screaming to himself in the dugout. I mean, he was crazy about it. But at least it's intensity. At least it's, you know, there's two ways to manifest that feeling. One way is to do what Gleyber Torres has done in the past and what Carlos Rodon has done in the past, and mope and be sad. And to take that frustration and that anger and maybe yell a little bit, but ultimately sit there and be sad and practically have to cover your face with your hat because you're crying in the dugout. And then there's the screaming, yelling manifestation of it all, and it comes out that way. And I think certainly in a team with a physical sport, I think you could argue the manifestation of anger is probably more productive than moping around. So on some level, it just there probably needed to be someone to just stand up and say, I can't take this crap anymore. And even though, I mean, clearly Gleyber didn't do anything. I mean, it was misguided. They gave you the numbers. He turned it in the 95th percentile of how fast double plays are turned. Like, there was no issue. I watched the play. I've seen Gleyber be lazy. That double play was just not hit hard enough, and Vidi ran his ass off. That's it. And there was a play before where, you know, he's playing a double play depth and the ground ball gets through, and it's unfortunate, especially when Stroman's pitching every single pitch outside. You would like the shift not to be where it was, and I think that was probably part of his thinking. It's like, I'm attacking the outside corner on every stinking pitch. Can you shade that way a little bit? And then the double play, and it was all too much. Now, I think it had some play on it, but also the benching, everything. But for me, it's the home run of Soto. It's the Soto home run that relaxes everybody. It's a three-run home run. It's on a 3-0 count, and it's done by the star. All of those things play into account. And it's a bomb that gives them the lead. That allowed everybody to breathe. It felt like finally we got the big hit that put us ahead. And that's, you know, the benching, Stroman, and I joked in a conspiracy theory that Stroman did it to make him a sympathetic figure. Because there's no way, like, that's the ultimate teammate. The ultimate teammate of Stroman is like, wow, the fans are getting all over him. Because the day before, Stroman put out a tweet about, you know, the media who don't play the game like to talk. And it almost felt like it was directed at the media about Gleyber Torres. That's how I construed it. It was a tweet defending Gleyber Torres. And it was almost like, hey, I'm going to scream and yell at this guy, and everyone's going to be mad at me, the bad guy who sends out the bad tweets, who had a problem with the Yankee fans in the past. I'm an easy target. I will put the target on myself. I will yell at Glaber for no reason at all, and everybody will go, man, don't yell at Glaber like that. He didn't do anything wrong. And then suddenly Glaber is no longer the hatred, the hated player that he was. Now it's like, hey, man, leave Glaber alone. He didn't do anything wrong. But that's all just, you know, fun stuff. What honestly happened is he got pissed off and yelled. And the team needed to hear somebody yell. And they've heard the manager yell, and there's no doubt. People think the manager doesn't yell. He yells. Look at the way the guy handles umpires. He just doesn't yell publicly at his players. He yells in the clubhouse, there's no doubt. But they needed a player to show the frustration. And I think it helped. Now, this is the difference between winning and losing. If on that 3-0 count, Soto hits into a double play, then the yelling and the screaming from Stroman sucks. And it's unwarranted, and it's a problem. Because they lost the game. That is the difference right there in winning and losing. That's the difference. Winning cures all. If he was yelling at Gleyber Torres, and they lost that game, and they got beat 6-1, the story of that game is Stroman can't act like that. And this team is falling apart. And you've got pitchers pitted against each other, pitted against their infielders. We saw it the night before with Rodon. It's a major problem. You can't allow your pitchers to act this way. That's the story of the game. He hits the home run. Glaber gets hot. They score 16 runs. Hey, you know what? The Yankees needed it. That's the difference between winning and losing. Between living and dying. 888-808-1019, 888-808-1019. McMonagle with you. Come back, Dan. I see you. We'll take your phone calls. We'll get you all the way to 5 o'clock in the warm-up show. We're talking baseball. We're talking Giants and Hard Knock. Hard Knocks. Brian Daboll calling plays. Aaron Rodgers in Egypt, if you want to talk about that. The Rangers and their offseason. Hartenstein no longer a Nick. All of it on the table. Getting to you all the way till 5 o'clock in the warm-up show. McMonagle here with you in the overnights right here on The Fan. Oh, come on. This is not... What song is it? Which one is this?
I had to play one you didn't mention.
Oh, no. You got to play one of the ones I mentioned.
You said the whole album was good.
Well, I said the album was good. It's got a couple. I don't even know this song, to be honest with you. I don't remember this one. It must have been one I skipped over. What's the name of it?
Look at You.
Yeah, I don't know this one. Now you got to play Madeline. You got to play, you know, one of the yearbook where Johnny disappears in the yearbook. But they can play. That, I'm telling you. Check out Middle of Nowhere. Hanson's pretty good. Not saying they don't have any bad songs. I didn't particularly like that one right there. Making me look bad. And I mean, that's the producer's job, I guess. Screen phone calls where I get called a douche. Try and make me look bad for having a thought about Hanson. You know, that's typical what you're supposed to do. Sounds about right. Sounds about right. Let's get to the phone calls. Do you see this? Like, the... I haven't mentioned, I don't think I have, the viral sensation that has been the Hawk Tua girl. I don't think I've mentioned her at all. But all of a sudden, I don't know what happened. And she certainly wasn't in hiding, but she's handled this slightly different than other people who have, you know, found themselves in these sort of, I don't know how else to put it, but I guess initially unfortunate moments where it goes viral. I can't, like, there's no way immediately she was pleased with it. Like, there's no way. Like, now she's making the most of it, and she's going to realize it's probably the best thing that ever happened to her. But in the moment, there's got to be that just sheer embarrassment. Like, people are picking up on this. You know, I would think, unless you're, you know, I don't know, Marash. But, like, I don't know how you couldn't be embarrassed by this initially. So, much like the Oilers fan who flashed at the stadium, like she disappeared for a while. I think she was having a tough time coming to terms with it. The first video she puts out is like to all the haters, and I'm like, who hated on that video? Everybody loved that video. Yeah, the woman on the plane, I mean, that she seemed really out there and, you know, not in the best of mental capacity in that moment, where this is more of like a drunken silliness. But, like, those, they hid for a little bit, then they came out, and sure, you know, the airplane girl, I forget her name, but she went on Barstool. She kind of got affiliated with them in some way. I know she was, I don't know if she's dating one of the producers there or just like, you know, hanging out with one of the producers there, whatever the case may be. But Hawk Tua girl got into merchandising like immediately. And there are bumper stickers and there are t-shirts. I just saw on Facebook a kid I went to high school with is like out on a 40th birthday with, you know, for one of his friends' 40th birthday. I think it's a girl. It's like a couples thing where a bunch of them are out for this 40th birthday. And like they're wearing Hawk Tua 24 t-shirts. Like she really got into the merchandising thing. Fantastic. And she's making a ton of money with merchandise. I don't think anybody else jumped out into the merchandising as good as well as she has. And now all of a sudden, I haven't seen her, heard from her, anything. And now there's pictures of her and Shaq. She's doing podcasts. Now she's out and about. And she's going to try and make the most of this. And, you know, good for her.
Yeah, she just did the interview with Zach Bryan's girlfriend or whatever.
Right, right. And she admitted some of the, and she debunked some of the theories. She is not a school teacher. That came out that she was a school teacher and had been fired because of the video. That is not true. Her father is not a preacher. That is not true.
I don't think, from the clips I saw, I don't think she was ever embarrassed by this. So she's like,
maybe
I'm
not
a 21-year-old girl who says stupid things all the time. That one happened to be on camera. I mean.
Well, I understand that. But still, then it was, you know, spread around the world. Like, I say, you know, you say dumb things, I get it. But then when it's there for everyone to see and it's becoming this big thing, I would think there's got to be some level of, oh my God, I can't believe I did that. No, none? I think so. There's got to be an initial kind of, oh my God, what did I get myself into?
Amazingly, I can't relate.
No, well, that's obviously. But I'm just saying, like, yeah, then it might dawn on you, like, wow, this is so big, I can capitalize on it, no doubt. But initially, I don't know if you think it's going to get to that point. You just think, oh my God, it's actually making the rounds a little bit. Before you know it, I mean, it's everywhere. But yeah, pictures of her and Shaq debunking all the stuff. But the merchandising really impresses me. We're at the point at already. You see pictures like taken on the road of bumper stickers. Like I said, I went to a kid in high school. I went to high school with a kid who's literally on a party and they're all wearing Hawk Tua 24 shirts. Which after the other night doesn't sound like a terrible idea. Crazy enough. That was some spectacle. That, I mean, that debate was, I don't even know what to say. I didn't talk about it that night that much because I just felt like if I talked about it, I don't really have anybody to banter with about it. So it's just me giving my opinion and then, it might just, I depend so much on the calls that it would just be call after call. But, I mean, amazing. It's amazing that that's what we have. That's the choice. Dan in Belmar. What's up, Dan?
Hey, Chris.
What's up, buddy?
Listen, I've seen your swing. I know your swing. You're not a 6 handicap, right?
I won the tour championship and that, you know, not just the seniors, but the regular tour. And that takes, you know, you got to be smart up there.
You got to be smart. You got to be smart.
Can you believe that?
Anyway, hey, let me ask you real quick since you're on the topic. Hawk 2, is that patent pending, trademark pending?
No, it's still pending.
Yeah. It would have to because it takes too long.
Okay, well, I mean, whatever. But yes, she's going to own it. She's going to own it. I'm pretty sure it's her too. Like, I did read that she's like making the money off of it. It's not like other people are doing it. But I'm sure that there's someone benefiting off it. I thought I did read. Now you made me think that maybe someone else is benefiting. But I thought I did read that she's got into the merchandising. So,
well, I'm happy for her.
Yeah, why not? God bless her.
Anyway, back to real problems.
Yes,
the Mets bullpen.
Yes.
Looking at it, obviously, it's a major area of concern. Moving forward, you can't keep throwing these guys out there, the Matt Festas and the Tyler J, whatever his name is.
Yeah, I know.
Tonight that almost blew it.
Well, yeah, right now you're just trying to fill the void. No doubt. They're going to have to add.
Diaz is back and, you know.
Well, that's one step. You probably need more than that. But, yeah, that's one step at least, yes.
So, yeah, looking at it, you know, down the line, the end of the month, the trade deadline, teams that are most likely going to be out of it and, you know, areas of need that the Mets could fill for those teams. I think the Pirates make the most sense for the Mets. I think they bring back a familiar face in Colin Holderman. That's who was traded for Mr. Daniel Vogelback, if you'll remember. Mm-hmm. He's having a shutdown year.
Mm-hmm.
So this trade that I'm thinking sends over, the Pirates are going to send over Holderman, Chapman, and Connor Joe, along with Mitch Keller. The Mets will send out Beatty, a Peterson, Mauricio, and Tyrone Taylor. Let me know what you think about that.
I mean, it's a give it to me one more time.
Mets are going to send Brett
right.
Beatty,
yeah,
David Peterson, Ronnie Mauricio, and Tyrone Taylor.
Okay.
And the Pirates are going to send over to the Mets Colin Holderman, who's on a one-year deal, is expiring after this year. Chapman, also same case.
Yeah.
Connor Joe, utility guy, and Mitch Keller, front-end starter.
Yeah. I mean, it's too wide. It's too widespread and too many tentacles to it to really consider it a mid-season trade. Like I understand what you're trying to do there. I mean, you're giving up Mauricio, you're giving up Beatty, and you're getting, you know, relievers that can help you. No doubt, and you're getting a frontline starter. But I mean, it's just too hard. And plus, right now, I mean, they're right there. Pittsburgh's three games out. I don't know if they want to be trading frontline starters. You know, I understand what it provides, but that's the problem. I mean, can you convince me both teams get better for stretch runs there?
The only thing I'm thinking with Pittsburgh is I don't know if these guys, the Skeens and the Jones of their team, are going to be throwing deep into the year. I don't know if they're going for it this year with them being young arms, and they want to protect their arms.
Right.
So, I don't know if they view this as the year they're going for it or if they're going to try and stock up. They have these guys for a while, the Skeens and Jones.
Yeah.
Stock up. On other prospects. Right now they need help up the middle, the Pirates do, and the Mets clearly need help in the bullpen. And then, you know, if this trade were to happen, then the Mets can afford, since they have Mitch Keller, to trade away a Severino or, you know, kind of be buyers and sellers at the deadline, like Stearns has talked about.
Yeah, I know, which I hate, by the way. I just hate the idea. I don't think they want to trade away Keller. I just don't think they want to trade away good young players like that. I don't know. It's a lot. It's impossible to give you a real take on. I mean, you're talking about two teams that are in the middle of it. You're trading away multiple picks. I mean, I just think it's too ambitious a trade to actually have happen. It's just too ambitious a trade to have happen. I mean, very rarely do you see deadline moves where you're trading frontline. You're asking them to trade a frontline starter and two relievers for Mauricio and Beatty, who's been a failed major league prospect at this point. I mean, you might have faith in him or believe in him, or, you know, the talent is there. But, I mean, that's asking a lot of Pittsburgh so you can go win and beat them when they're right there for it. Like, I don't know. It's too convoluted and too complicated for a trade deadline. If you want to do it in the offseason, those are the kind of deals that get done in the offseason. They don't get done under the pressure of a pennant race and a trade deadline. It's very simplistic. Every once in a while, right, we saw Bader for Montgomery. Like, every once in a while, you will see something like that. And when it's done like that, it's very simplistic. It's one for one, two for two, one for two, something along those lines. That's it. But very rarely do you see pieces like that interchange. You typically see, like, if they want to move Keller because they believe they're selling and they have the starting pitching depth with the other answers they have there and they want to get prospects back, then they'll just move Keller. Or obviously Chapman's someone they'll move, but they just move them and get prospects back. They don't want to give you their current players. Like, it's not now. It doesn't make sense. It's too much. That's a little bit too convoluted. And that's why, you know, It's hard to justify these trades. It's hard to and again to get back to the Mets and selling and buying at the same time. I despise it. You can't do. It's very difficult to do both, and it makes no sense. It really doesn't make any sense to me because it's making assumptions, and I hate making assumptions. You're assuming you have depth at places. You're assuming. Kodai Senga could come back and get hurt tomorrow. Kodai Senga could be crappy. Kodai Senga hasn't pitched in forever. You can't assume Kodai Senga is coming back to bolster your rotation. You can't assume Scott is going to pitch great the rest of the year. You can't assume that you have Peterson and you have, you know, Lucchese and you have Buto and you have, like, you have no idea. You can't trade Severino when you're adding those. Like, you need, if you're going to go for it and add, you don't subtract from your strength. Like, Severino is one of your strength pieces. If you're selling, then you're selling, and you sell him, no doubt. But what if you do that? What if you sell and buy, and then you have a problem with the starting rotation? He goes and pitches great wherever he goes, and you're like, man, we could have won if we kept Severino. I would not be able to. I wouldn't do that. If I'm looking for pitching prospects, if I'm looking for bullpen guys, I'm trading pitching prospects. I'm trading prospects away. I'll trade just one Buto for a couple of relievers or whatever. Like, that's it. Guys who haven't been here, I can't trade Severino's right now, their best starting pitcher. Because I'm assuming they have some sort of depth that could be washed away in a day. Especially pitchers. You can't assume. If you're going to buy, you're going for it. And if you're going for it, you don't sell. It's that simple. It doesn't make any sense to me. I mean, I understand the thought. I understand, well, we have depth here. We need this. We could trade this either for that or get assets that will help us get that or whatever the case. Just go get the, you have assets. What do you think you're getting for Severino that's suddenly going to change everything about what you can offer for a reliever? You have assets. Go trade one. You got a young player. Go trade one. The formula has changed. The team has outperformed what you thought. The offense is better than you thought. The team is winning inside a terrible National League. Let's be honest. Or at least a lesser middle of the pack. Yeah, you still got the top players. What about Logan Gilbert? You do what for Logan Gilbert?
I'd give Pete Alonso. They need a hitter in Seattle. They have so many starting pitchers.
I mean, that's a move. That's a move. If you think the roster is and the lineup right now has been good enough without him, you can put Vientos at first base and play Beatty at third, and you want to move Alonso because you haven't had anywhere near any sort of progress in a contract, and you can get a legitimate rotation, a young rotation piece like Logan Gilbert, yeah, that's a trade.
Or George Kirby or Brian Wu, any of the three.
Right. Yeah. Well, is he hurt now? Is he back?
Wu is hurt, but the MRI was clean. So.
Okay. So, yeah, I mean, that's a move that could possibly work. But that's not buying or selling. That's exchanging in some way.
That's similar to the Harrison Bader trade that you
correct. That's Montgomery for Bader, right. On a different scale, but yes. I don't know how I feel about that either. That makes sense.
Both teams are playoff teams. One has a deficiency at offense. One has a deficiency in starting pitching.
Right. That kind of move can make a little bit of sense. Now, again, I don't know if they would do that. I mean, how many years? I mean, what is this? You have at least 3 years of one of those starting pitchers for 6 months.
Right. So all three of those guys are going to have to get paid at some point, though. So if you think that, you know,
yeah, but you're trading a big asset for a rental. I mean, I don't love it on the Seattle standpoint. I hear what you're saying, but they do need offense desperately, no doubt. And I mean, Rodriguez is having a miserable year. He's got an OPS. This is half the year now. He's got an OPS under 7.
Same for Corbin Carroll.
Yeah, I know. Corbin Carroll's having a terrible second year. And that leads me to the Volpe conversation. A little bit, as those two players are, you know, the young faces of the franchise, and by no means is Volpe the face of the franchise. But I said this yesterday, and I've been thinking about it even more. And the more I think about it, the more I think I'm right, which is typically what happens. But when Anthony Volpe first got moved to the top of the order, if you remember, Glaber was hitting leadoff. And Glaber got off to the bad start, and really he's continued on that path up until the last couple of days. But when they moved Volpe to leadoff, I said, I'm okay with it. But now it doesn't change. It doesn't change no matter how he struggles. It doesn't matter what happens. He's the leadoff hitter. We talked about him being the leadoff hitter of the future, or at least Boone did. Don't move him. Don't move him. And now, since that, this is now going to be the second time I'm suggesting moving him. Because I talked about watching him hit leadoff and not being able to utilize his speed. I wanted DJ LeMay to hit leadoff if he can prove he could be a hitter. Now, he hasn't come anywhere near proving that, so I have never once suggested actually doing it. It was a thought if things worked out in a certain way where I could like the structure of the lineup better with LeMahieu on top and Volpe stealing bases, hitting sixth or seventh, where you could try and manufacture runs at the bottom of the lineup with stolen bases as opposed to risk getting thrown out in front of Soto and Judge, which I don't like. But LeMahieu hasn't even approached anywhere near making that even a thought. But now I have another thought, and I talked about it yesterday. Volpe's struggling here. Let's just be honest about it. And not only is he struggling, but the offense is struggling. I know they've scored some runs. They scored 16 the other day, scored enough yesterday to win a game. They scored 7 even in the loss to the Mets. But it's been so Judge-heavy. And, you know, just the whole lineup feels a little, you know, stuck. I wouldn't mind changing the top of the order. And the more I'm thinking about it, the more I kind of like it. I also, it does two separate things. One, putting Soto leadoff and Judge third gets the best on base percentage guy in baseball leading off. Right? That's the first and foremost. It gets the best on base guy to lead off. Now, he's got some pop, sure, but hey, so does Lindor. He's hitting leadoff and doing a bang up job. Right? So does Schwarber. He's been hitting leadoff for a team that's been, he can't run. You don't need speed. The speed at the top of the order is a little overblown these days. In a perfect world, yes. All right, but Ricky Henderson isn't here. And watch what others, I mean, Lindor doesn't have real speed. He can run a little bit, but he doesn't have speed. And Schwarber can't move, and yet he's hit leadoff. And I don't think anybody's quibbled about what the Phillies have done over the last 2 years. So moving Soto puts the best on-base percentage guy in baseball hitting leadoff. It separates them from being back-to-back, where once you get through that, sort of, it's now easier. It still gets them both in the first inning, and it opens up the two slot to be anything you want it to be, whether it's you put the hottest hitter in the lineup there to make sure he gets fastballs, or you put a currently like Gleyber Torres in there, or you put a Verdugo in there, and you try and get them fastballs, because that would be the most prime real estate in all of baseball, right? I mean, that is as good as it gets. To hit second behind Juan Soto and in front of Aaron Judge, you are going to get fastballs. You are going to be pitched to. Nobody is going to mess around. You are not going to get 3-1 changeups and sliders hitting second in front of Judge and behind Soto. So you can almost use it as a get-right spot. Or you could use it as whoever's the hottest and you go along with the most dangerous top of the order you can come up with. You can use it in a myriad of ways. But the more I'm thinking about it, you could put Volpe there if you want to get Volpe hot. Like, I'm not opposed to it. But there are two things when people suggest breaking up Juan Soto and Judge that I have, like, there's a certain thing I have to have. I have to have them hit in the first inning. I cannot allow a starting pitcher to get his feet underneath him and get through a first inning without facing both of them. So I'm open to breaking them up, but first and third is the only way to go because I need them hitting in the first inning, both of them. It's a non-negotiable thing for me. I cannot allow, especially, I mean, we all know it. We've been saying it forever. You got to get to a good starting pitcher early. I am not allowing a starting pitcher to not have to face both of those guys in the first inning. So the only way to split them up, in my mind, is first and third. And now that creates one hell of a spot in the order for someone I'm trying to get hot, someone I'm trying to get going, or someone who is just killing it, and now I have the most dangerous top three I could possibly have. I rotate it. It doesn't have to be the same person. It can change game to game. And I know Yankee fans hate that. You want the set lineup, and I get it. But right now with the Yankees struggling, I mean, we all love, right, Billy Martin. Billy Martin wouldn't have tolerated this crap. Billy Martin would have, you know, kicked Gleyber Torres' ass. Billy Martin would have done this. Billy Martin would have done that. Well, Billy Martin also drew lineups out of a hat when offenses were struggling. So as long as the offense is struggling in some way, now if they get hot here, I know they're not going to do it now. They're just not going to. And if they get hot here and they sweep Cincinnati, maybe I put this idea in the, you know, my back pocket. But if they continue to struggle offensively and it's just Soto and Judge doing all of the damage, I really like that idea. And it gives the ability for Volpe to relax a little bit, back of the lineup. I'm not putting him ninth, but I'll put him like sixth or seventh. And try and steal, if he gets on sixth, now I can steal bases with seventh. If he hits a double, now I'm bunting. If I had, everyone wants to manufacture runs, everyone wants to move runs over, everyone talks about productive outs with this Yankee lineup. I can't do that with Volpe in front of Soto and Judge. I'm not bunting. I'm not worried about productive outs. I'm trying to mash with them. But if Volpe gets on first, steals second base, now the seventh hitter is up. Now I got Grisham coming up. Now I got either Verdugo, or I got Jones, or I got Wells, or I got Trevino coming up. Now I can bunt. Now I don't worry about him. I'm trying to manufacture runs. If he gets thrown out, hey, I'm trying to score runs. He got thrown out. Now I can play that game of small ball with Volpe at the bottom of the order, and I've created a sweet spot in that two-hole where I can get guys going. I can put my hottest hitter. I can manipulate that and move that around. I think it opens up the lineup. I think it makes it more dynamic, it gives them more options, and it utilizes Volpe's best tool of his speed, which right now I feel is a little bit lost. He's still stolen some bases, but it's a little bit lost. Now, yes, he's getting fastballs in a good spot in front of Soto and Judge. I get that. And if Trevino's behind him, is he going to get good pitches? Maybe not. But he gets kind of swing happy anyway. I'm not as worried about that with him, but I can put him second if I'm trying to get him going. But I just think that creates a little bit of a unique opportunity at the two-hole, and it moves Volpe down to where I can use his ability to manipulate and try and manufacture runs at the bottom of the lineup instead of waiting for the one home run a month from Trevino. It changes the way they can go about playing the game. So if that would be my move if the lineup continues to struggle here with the Yankees.
And then Vlad Guerrero will just bat second between Soto.
And then when you trade for Vlad, he hits second, or McMahon, and he hits second. I mean, it's just a dynamics. I mean, that is name another. Like, I guess if they had, you know, with the Angels last year in between Trout and Ohtani, like, that's literally what it is.
Or it's anywhere in the Dodgers lineup now.
Well, I mean, the bottom of the lineup isn't that good. But yes, right, anywhere between Betts, who's injured right now, but Betts, Freeman, or Ohtani, yes, that's pretty good real estate. But nobody's clamoring to break them up. They have a worse record than the Yankees. Nobody's claiming the Dodgers are falling apart.
That's because there's no WFAN in L.A.
That's a good point. That is a good point. They probably have some facsimile of, but they're not. They don't yell like this. They don't go to the games. They leave early. We know all the nonsense that goes on in L.A. 888-808-1019. 888-808-1019. But yes, I like that. I like that. I do. And you know what else? We like to talk, especially, I didn't give a topic today. I forgot to. Typically on these five-hour midnight rides, I like to talk about something about movies or music, although I did give you Hanson. I can't wait for the reaction to that one. Telling you, it's good. Madeline, here we go around again. It's a good song. But I talked about this on Sunday, but it's a different audience, and I want to say it now. Because there's a movie trend. I just saw Inside Out 2. I talked about that. But there's a movie trend going on right now that I don't understand. I'm having a real problem. And in a world where we talk about constantly having remakes and sequels and no new clever ideas, what we've also seen sometimes is similar movies all coming out around the same time with similar premises a lot. It's almost like a movie will get shopped at at a company or at a, you know, a movie company, and they didn't like it. It went somewhere else. But then they were like, you know what? That's a decent idea. Let's try and write one of our own. And for whatever reason, I just saw a trailer on Sunday that I'm befuddled by, and I don't understand it. Because now it's the third movie similar to it with the same theme. The Rock and Chris Evans, Captain America, are making a movie where Santa Claus, played by J.K. Simmons, who is buff and working out in the beginning of the trailer of it. So it's like a buff Santa Claus action movie. Like, when this is now the third. Now, they're not all exactly the same, but it's the third Santa Claus action movie we have seen over the last handful of years. Mel Gibson did Fat Man about 4 years ago, maybe 3 or 4 years ago, where he plays like a fed up Santa Claus who people are coming to get him. I don't know. And then the guy from Stranger Things just had some sort of action Santa Claus movie. And now The Rock is like a Secret Service agent who protects Santa Claus, and Santa Claus gets kidnapped. And it's like an action film with The Rock around Santa Claus. Why would we need three Santa Claus action movies in as many years?
But Violent Night was awesome.
I didn't see it, but
that's the one with the with
right, the guy from Stranger Things.
So good.
I'm sure it is. I'm not even doubting that. But how many of these movies are going to come out? Like, it's just that we find so many ways to be non-creative. Like, oh, that one seemed pretty good. Let's do another Santa Claus movie. But here's the twist. It's an action movie with The Rock. Like, yeah, I know. We just did this. And it's not that appealing to me, the Santa Claus action movies. I guess, you know, it's a different take. But, like, and I was, you know, joking Sunday. Like, well, what's next? Tooth Fairy? And he already did the Tooth Fairy, The Rock. But he could do, like, some sort of action movie now. I mean, it's just, I don't understand it. I don't understand why we always make the same movies over and over and over again. And now we got three action movies with Santa Claus. This one's called Red One, because that's his code name for the Secret Service agent The Rock calls. So we got the protection thing. He gets kidnapped. There's violence. Like, do I really need to see Santa Claus kill henchmen three times in the last 5 years? And by the way, I hate to ruin it for you. I don't know if you saw the trailer. Now, I'm not going to call it a spoiler because I haven't seen the movie. This is just my mind. I want it on the record. The twist at the end of the movie is that J.K. Simmons, Santa Claus, is behind the whole thing. That it's a fake kidnapping. That he has got some ulterior motive to try and stop Christmas or ruin Christmas or something. And he did this all himself. And at the end, The Rock is going to have to stop him, and Santa Claus is the bad guy. You could see it coming a million miles away. Just so you know. 888-808-1019. McMonagle here with you. Let's take Eric real quick, and then we'll get to the break. What's up, Eric?
Yeah, hey, Sam, I know you got the break from up. Look, as far as the movies, it's really not unique that they've done this, though. I mean, look what, in the late 90s, they had Deep Impact and Armageddon came out.
Right.
Basically, a couple months apart.
No, of course,
same thing
I know.
With all the disaster movies, you know, the 2012 and yeah. Day After Tomorrow. And,
yes.
I mean, they all tend to come out, you know, like...
Around the same time.
They did Twister, and there was like another tornado movie that came out, like, you know. So it's not that unusual, but I see what you're saying. I mean, actually, if it turned out that Santa was the bad guy, that would actually be a kind of an interesting twist. But we'll see if that holds you up to it. But
yeah, no, I'm telling you.
I understand what you're saying. I mean, it's just they used to have Silent Night, Deadly Night, which was Santa going on a horror killing spree over like a bad 80s movie.
A movie called Krumpus, where it was
the Krumpus was that was like a Christmas demon kind of
right, a Christmas thing, demon or something.
Right. So they're doing all sorts of they're turning all the Winnie the Pooh and Disney.
I know, I saw that.
Horror, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah. So
Pooh, Honey and Blood. You know? I know. I didn't see the movie, but I was aware of it. We talked about it back in the Carton and Robert days. Yes, and it looked ridiculous because it wasn't Winnie the Pooh. It was like some guy in a Winnie the Pooh mask. It looked like as if it was just a murderer who decided to dress like Winnie the Pooh. It wasn't believable that it was actually an aged, grown-up, and pissed-off Winnie the Pooh. It just looked like, you know, a 300-pound guy in a Winnie the Pooh mask, which is, I'm not saying it can't be scary. If done right, it could be terrifying. But it doesn't sell me as this is really Christopher Robin returning to whatever land, and here's Winnie the Pooh who's pissed off because Christopher Robert left. And now he's a big killer. I mean, it wasn't like a real bear. It was a person. It was a dude in a mask. It looked ridiculous. But you're right. This is not new. They make these movies. It feels like, this is what it feels like to me. It feels like someone goes to Paramount with a script and says, I have an idea for a violent Santa Claus movie. And they go, that's ridiculous. Get the hell out of my office. And then they get on the phone. And they're like, Ted, write a script for a violent Santa Claus movie. Because I think this is right up Miramax's, expertise, and I think they're going to do it. And it's all like all of a sudden, like it's a like all these different movie companies got a wind of one script, and they said we'll write one just like it and see if we can make it better. And then they all released the movies at the same time. But I don't know if you heard, The Rock is coming out with a movie called Red One, where he plays like a Secret Service agent. I'm sure it's not the Secret Service; it's its own Christmas Secret Service agent, where he's protecting J.K. Simmons, Santa Claus. Who's like all buff and like in the trailer, he's working out and everything, and he gets kidnapped and he hires Christopher Evans, Captain America, the guy who played Captain America, to like, he's a master tracker and they're trying to find Santa Claus, and it's like this violent action movie based around Santa. And they just had like two. They had the guy from Stranger Things, Silent Night or whatever it was called, Violent Night. He's Santa Claus killing everybody. A couple years ago, Mel Gibson did a movie called Fat Man, where they come and try and find Santa and attack Santa.
Where the hell have I been? I don't know any of these movies.
Yeah, no, they're there.
I can't get past Honey and Blood. That's hilarious.
Yeah. Honey and Blood.
Yeah. I'm sorry, the name of it's... Yeah. You hooked me with the name, now I need to go see it.
And it's just him and Piglet, because those are the only two characters that the licensing ran out on and they were able to get. So it's literally Winnie the Pooh and Piglet, but it's no joke, it is an enormous guy in a Winnie the Pooh mask and then an enormous guy in a pig mask. Like, it's not Piglet, not wearing the striped shirt. Like, all of a sudden, Piglet grew, you know, 400 pounds and is chasing everybody. And it looks, it's not that it's not scary, because it can be terrifying. A man in a Winnie the Pooh mask chasing everybody and killing people, that's scary enough.
I got to tell you, all of this sounds like I'm in for all of it. Yeah. I love a good, what the hell am I watching? This is awful. Right. I'm hooked. I can't turn the channel movie.
Right.
I'm all for it.
Sure.
These sound terrible and awesome all at the same time.
Well, the Winnie the Pooh, Honey and Blood, yes, that definitely sounds... I mean, horror movie isn't my thing, but they're trying to play it off.
I like horror movies, and good ones
right.
you like more than the what is this garbage, but I can't stop looking at it, kind of like a train wreck type of thing. But these actually sound awful good.
Yeah.
And I mean that as in like awful and good, not awfully good.
Right, no, I understand what you're saying. Yes. You got to look at the trailer for the Winnie the Pooh one, because
I got to see all of this now. Well, I have no idea with any of these things.
Well, The Rock is like, it's going to be a big
Knight?
Movie.
I'm curious on that.
It's fantastic.
Yeah, he saw it and he liked it.
I'm curious.
Me and Gallo talked about it on Christmas because it has a great playlist, and we played some songs from it on Christmas morning here, and Gallo agreed that it was a great movie.
So. Why is this all built around like Santa and Christmas, though?
I don't know.
Okay.
That's what I'm saying. Oh. Like, why all of a sudden is this such a great idea?
You think it's the piggyback thing where Armageddon comes out, so Deep Impact comes out 5 minutes later?
Bingo. That's, 2012 comes out, so, you know, the coldest day ever, whatever that stupid movie was.
With Day After Tomorrow.
Day After Tomorrow. Like, they all come out around the same time.
I mean, Hollywood's not exactly...
That's my whole point.
Original.
I know. And I'm baffled that this has been the next idea where suddenly it's like, oh, we all need one of these movies.
Olympus Has Fallen, White House Down also came out right around the same time.
Exactly right. We got to protect the president.
Yeah. I mean, again, they'd like to do remakes. And then once they hear of one script, they'll wind up, if they think one is going to succeed, they roll out three or four and see which one's going to be the best one.
Right.
And they basically bet against each other.
Correct.
Almost like the movie that I just saw for the first time, The Big Short, where you bet against something, so they short against the other movie to see if they can do one a little bit better. I just didn't realize that a violent Santa was the way we're going right now.
That's my point.
I was unaware.
That's my point. My point is, this is a weird one to pick. Like, violent... I mean,
The Big Short's great, too, by the way.
I feel like violent... great movie. I feel like violent Santas, though, there's a lot there. It's easy, and that's part of what Hollywood likes, so it's easy to be able to turn that and switch it and make it a horror movie. It's just that you got to do it properly, otherwise you got a mess.
Okay. Well, yeah, it's not a horror movie, it's an action movie. with The Rock. It's not really a horror movie.
Well, then I'm less inclined.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's, I mean, I didn't say it was a horror movie. It's an action movie.
I get distracted by Winnie.
Well, yeah. Again,
the poo and blood. I got distracted. Really the, sorry. Yeah. My mind went to horror. No. I would prefer a horror movie with the Santa instead of.
No, it's The Rock, and he's got all gadgets.
Nah, again, you said Captain America's looking for him, and and he's like a tracker. Yeah.
Yeah.
Nah, I don't really care anymore.
No.
I lost interest. That happened fast.
I already know what happens in the movie from watching the trailer for 2 minutes.
Well, let's be fair. How many trailers do you watch that you already know what happens in the movie anyway?
Yeah, I mean, that's what because they give it away. One, Santa gets kidnapped, right, at the beginning of the movie. Why is it J.K. Simmons? Why is it an actor like that? You know he's going to get involved at the end, and he's all buff and everything. You can tell, like, he's being kidnapped. He doesn't even look concerned. He's the bad guy. Santa Claus is the bad guy. There's no doubt. There's no doubt in my mind. It turns out this whole thing was a big facade, and Santa planned his own kidnapping, and he's trying to stop Christmas or something. It's 100%. It's a lock, guaranteed.
Just so I'm clear, because J.K. Simmons, the name, and I'm trying to put he's the one that Spider-Man,
Correct.
I forget the paper guy.
Correct.
Okay, that's
J.K. Simmons. He's the drum teacher in Whiplash.
Okay. I didn't see. But okay. All right. Now I got it. Okay. Mm-hmm. And you're right. He is actually, he's a lot more ripped than you would think. Oh, no man, but
he's in great shape.
Yeah. You would never think it from the roles he plays.
No, like Santa. You wouldn't think, hey, let's get a ripped Santa.
Yeah, that doesn't really fit with
him. No, it doesn't.
Yeah.
None of it makes any sense.
Mm.
Everyone knows Coca-Cola made up Santa, and they made him chubby.
Whoa, so you're saying
888-808-1019. No, I mean, yeah, he's real. They just gave him the outfit, and then he adjusted. He didn't always wear the red outfit with the beard and everything. He just said, well, I mean, if that's how they're going to portray me. Again, as I said before, when the legend becomes myth, you print the legend. That's it. Santa realized, hey, I can't just be, you know, kicking around in overalls anymore. They've done this thing. It's clearly successful. And while I don't plan on palling around with polar bears, I'll do the rest of it.
So Honey and Blood
and
Violent Night. All right.
Yes.
Okay. All right. Mm-hmm. All right.
And Whiplash. Whiplash is great, too.
I don't know what that is.
That's the J.K. Simmons.
That's the one. He's a drum instructor, and he's out of his mind. And he flings, you know, cymbals at the kid for not being on time, slaps him in the face. Crazy.
I'm slightly interested.
Yeah. It's kind of a horror movie because it's terrifying to be the student. What's his name? He's another famous
Miles
actor,
Teller.
Miles Teller. He plays the student. Yeah, no, it's terrifying.
Am I warped? Is that what we're finding out?
No, not really. People like horror movies and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. It's not crazy. I'm not a big fan of them. Certainly not gore movies. I get no satisfaction from a chainsaw causing blood to splatter.
No. I need a plot. It can't be gore for gore.
It could be gore. No.
That I'm not so into. I mean, we've all seen blood. I don't need to see blood just for blood. I need a plot. I need a reason. Unless it's awful, then I don't need a reason. So you got to be you got to be good, or you got to be
so bad
that I can't look away.
Correct. I get
don't
you.
Be in the middle.
I hear what you're saying.
It's like life.
I hear what
don't
you're
be
saying.
In the middle.
Right. I hear what you're saying. That's why I chose to be so awful. 888-808-1019. McMonagle here with you on The Fan. We'll come back. Take your phone calls. Talk about the Mets and their important yet unimpressive victory against Washington as they start this 8-game road trip against the teams they're competing against in this National League. Yankees and Luis Gil take the mound tonight. The Rangers didn't do enough at the trade deadline, and the Knicks lost their center. All of it's still on the table for one more hour. 888-808-1019. Update time. Here's Marco.